Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. In Fairbanks for the third annual Midnight Sun Writers Conference is poet Wendy Rose. Her father is a Hopi from Arizona, and her mother is part Chachilla Miwok, Indians from the Gold Rush country of California. Wendy Rose says she's an urban Indian. But what is an urban Indian, and how Indian can you be when you're born and raised in the city?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I guess it gets down to semantics, because urban Indian is almost the only kind there can be, in a sense, because it's the white man that calls us Indian. And we're all put into this one category as if the entire country or the entire continent had been one culture. And, of course, this isn't true. There are hundreds and hundreds of Native cultures in the country. And really, when we get to the city, is the only time that we really think of ourselves as Indian, rather than, you know, just simply members of a particular tribe or a particular clan in a particular tribe or a particular family. And so, in a sense, being an urban Indian is also being a generalized Indian, especially in the Bay Area of California, because there are so many tribes. There are people from all over the country, even from Alaska. There are people from everywhere, from every conceivable tribe, all living in the Bay Area and relating to each other, having something in common, people that otherwise would never have met. And so the term Indian just sort of, I guess pan-Indian is another term that people use, sort of covers all of us in the city. But it hasn't been, for many people though, they have not dropped their tribal roots, but rather the urban pan-Indian identity exists alongside of the tribal identity.
You're saying pan-Indian as in encompassing all?
Multi-tribal.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of tribes together.
But can you be Indian in a city? Somehow being Indian has to be tied back to the land, to tradition. At least that's what, you know, you hear. And how Indian can you be if you're detached from that?
Well, this is what the anthropologists tell us, is that if we go to the city, that we have to stop being Indian. And what it means is that we stop being Indian as the anthropologists see us. But I think what's happened is that there is a new Indian society, a new Native society that has grown up among urban Indians that I can relate very well, for example, to urban Indians from pretty much any part of the continent, in some ways better than I can relate to the traditional people who are in my own tribe. And it's not that the relationship with the tribe has been broken off or has been cut or anything, but rather that this is like a new society. It's not assimilated into the white society, although it's adapted to it. It is still very, very Native, but it also is modified from what the tribal tradition is. It's a new thing. And a lot of the people who are still very much involved with the tribal tradition, I think, misunderstand what some of us in the city are doing. We're forming, in a sense, a new society, but we're trying to do it in such a way that it coexists peacefully with the traditional people and, if possible, helps to support the preservation and the continuing tribal structure. You know, even if we can't ourselves fully participate in it because we might have lost our language or because through intermarriage we might not be a member of the right clan or something like that, if we can't participate directly, then at least perhaps we can be supportive as intermediaries or something like that.
You seem to be comfortable with that and even enthusiastic about it, because you're saying it's a new society or a new move, but a lot of people that I talk to are very uncomfortable with that notion, that the whole idea that they don't belong in one place or the other. And how did you become persuaded that being an urban Indian is okay for you?
Well, I spent 30 years feeling the way you just described. You know, I was not accepted as a traditional Hopi because my mother is not Hopi, and that's really important there. The clan comes through the mother. And having a Hopi father didn't do me any good at all. You know, there's no place in the tribe for someone whose father is Hopi but whose mother isn't. And my mother is mixed blood. In her particular tribe, there are no full bloods left. The last ones died in the 1950s. And so it took me 30 years of having people tell me that I didn't belong anywhere before I finally came to terms with it. And I think my literature has helped a lot. Writing has helped a lot because very gradually the urban Indian people, I think, are accepting each other. There has been a kind of a structure, at least where I come from, where the Sioux would all go do one thing and the Navajos would all go do something else, and they would only get together every once in a while in a very structured kind of a setting. And there might be rivalry, you know, between different people. And then there would be rivalry between the people who had relatives on the reservation and those who didn't, and those who spoke their language and those who didn't. And this mm-hmm. sort of thing would be going on. But I felt that being able to contribute the poetry has really helped me find a niche in this urban society with other people who have been in my kind of a situation. I think we're finding each other now and just coming together.
Coming together through communication of these kinds of feelings and things?
Yeah, and also when we meet each other and we're honest with each other about our feelings and our experiences, we find out we're not alone. For 30 years, I thought that I was the only totally displaced Indian in the entire Bay Area, only to find out that there are hundreds of us.
Mm-hmm. You have, speaking of your work and your poems, one that I had heard, and I think it would be a good time to talk about it. The title is Questions for a Miwok Uncle, but maybe you should introduce it instead of me.
Well, it's interesting because the one thing in Alaska that I found that's really familiar is all the Gold Rush stuff and the pioneer motif and all this go in places and people have decorations of pickaxes and shovels. And this is familiar to me because, of course, in 1849, there was a Gold Rush very much like the Klondike that was in California. And the native people in California met pretty much the same fate as many of the native people up here, perhaps mm-hmm. even more so. You know, whole groups of people were wiped out. And so this is a poem that is about that gold rush and about my mother's heritage, which is coming out of the racial mixture that resulted from the gold rush, which is partly white, partly Sierra Nevada, California Indian, and partly Chinese. Questions for a Miwok Uncle. Spread-eagled uncle and preserved against some book. You have but the ashes of clapstick and bone flute to color your hands as you would have them before they came with their ranches and cattle, upturning and chewing our flesh, before they ripped memory from our tongues and riddled the hills with their hungry machines, before they came from their cities to measure our bones against a yardstick of stolen gold, a long time ago when they were still slumming among their own ancestors, practicing how they would approach you. Is it too late to record the monument of your movement, down and away from where you once were, parting the high grass with a song so quietly you came upon the deer drinking and put down the bow to watch the rhythm of their throats?
Well, a question that comes to my mind immediately after that is it too late?
Well, I don't know. I haven't gotten the answer yet to the question. It's a fairly new poem, and I guess I'm addressing the question not to a genuine Miwok uncle. And there are still Miwoks left. It's just the particular group my mother is from. There are no full bloods left, but there are Miwoks left in California. So the question really is addressed to that part of me, which is Miwok, that part of me which is native Californian. And in a sense, the uncle is the metaphor for that part of me, even though it was through my mother's line, because the Miwok people, in contrast to the Hopi, the Miwok people, the line comes through the father.
Mm-hmm.
So I've addressed this to an uncle.
The other thing I detected, or think I did in that poem, is bitterness. I think. You don't seem bitter to me just in conversation, but on that page that comes through.
The kinds of things that I talk about in the poems that definitely are bitter are the things that have happened to that country up there, to the Gold Rush country. What happened when the ranches and these people went to the hills, the Indian people, the Miwok people, were in the way, so they were exterminated or they were moved. My mother's tribe, for example, was moved from the area of Yosemite Valley, which is beautiful mountain area with waterfalls and lots of pine trees and firs and incense cedar trees. They were moved from this beautiful mountain area down into what is now the city of Fresno, which is in the bottom of a swampy valley that's real, real hot and dry and dusty. And most of them did not survive the move, and so a small remnant group tried to get back up into the hills, and they at that point had to intermarry with other tribes in order to live. So it's really a poem about destruction. It's about it's using the particular situation that I can look back in my mother's family and see, but it's also talking about the general situation that while in this particular case it was the mother lode in 1849 and 1850, it's also Alaska, it's also New York, it's also Florida, it's also El Salvador, it's also Brazil.
But is it only a poem that a native, an Indian, could write?
Oh, no. No. In this particular case, in the Miwok case, I don't think that anyone should say in a poem that they are Miwok unless they are, or Eskimo or anything else. I think you have to be honest and use integrity, but certainly you can have the same perception and you can express that perception, you know, regardless of who you are. You just have to be honest, and because this kind of destruction has been so widespread, doesn't matter who you are, you've probably, you know, your people have experienced it.
Would you read it again for me?
Again?
Mm-hmm.
Spread-eagled uncle and preserved against some book. You have but the ashes of clapstick and bone flute to color your hands as you would have them before they came with their ranches and cattle, upturning and chewing our flesh, before they ripped memory from our tongues and riddled the hills with their hungry machines. Before they came from their cities to measure our bones against a yardstick of stolen gold, a long time ago, when they were still slumming among their own ancestors, practicing how they would approach you. Is it too late to record the monument of your movement down and away from where you once were, parting the high grass with a song so quietly you came upon the deer drinking and put down the bow to watch the rhythm of their throats?
Wendy Rose, poet, anthropologist, Indian from California. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.